Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Raven Reviews Election 2016, weekly interviews on six crucial topics. Our goal is to provide you with in-depth explorations of big issues that aren't discussed in mainstream media coverage. So over the next 6 weeks, we're inviting some of our favorite thinkers to come talk with us about politics and religion and democracy and racism and scapegoating. For more information on our upcoming interviews, please visit the Raven Foundation website and like the Raven Foundation Facebook page. But today we have one of my most favorite thinkers, Dr. Robert Erickson. For those of you watching, you will see two things. First, that Dr. Erickson, we can't see his image. We've had some technical difficulties. We're starting about 15 minutes late because we've been trying to figure them out, but alas, we can't. So instead of Dr. Erickson's handsome face, we get HP Media Smart webcam. So that's just the way it is. We are going to keep going with this because the other thing that you may have seen if you are on the live chat is that Dr. Erickson and I spell our last name the same way. We spell it correctly. None of this S-O-N stuff. So you can call him Dr. Erickson, but I affectionately call him Uncle Bob. Hi, Uncle Bob.
Hello, Adam.
Thank you for being with us today. How's it going over there?
It's going fine, except for the fact that the camera is not willing to pick up my face. I apologize for that.
No, it happens. Technical issues. It's okay. You are in Palm Springs?
I am in Palm Springs, yes.
Awesome. You're going to a conference this evening, correct?
San Diego is hosting the German Studies Association beginning this evening.
Oh, nice.
And I plan to be there this evening. My wife and I have spent a couple days in Palm Springs as a warm-up for
nice.
A weekend meeting.
Awesome. Well, tell Aunt Judith hello for me.
Yes, yes.
I will give you a brief introduction, and then we will get into our conversation. But before I introduce you, I want everybody who's in the live show to know that Suzanne Ross, my colleague and co-founder at the Raven Foundation, is monitoring the chat room. And Suzanne will chime in with questions or comments. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Adam. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Suzanne.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Suzanne, and feel free to butt in whenever you would like, okay?
Okay.
Awesome. So Uncle Bob is a world-renowned historian, a sought-after speaker throughout the world, and a retired professor of history and Holocaust studies at Pacific Lutheran University. He is the author of multiple books and articles on Nazi Germany, including this one, Theologians Under Hitler, and the co-editor of this one, Betrayal. Look at that front cover of Reich. Right, Bishop Ludwig Mueller. I mean, this is a profound cover, Uncle Bob.
Yes, it is a little bit shocking to those who don't know how Christians behaved in the Nazi era.
Oh, just crazy. So we'll be talking more about that, obviously. Uncle Bob has also co-authored a book, well, other books, and his book, Theologians Under Hitler, was made into a documentary with the same name. You can purchase all of these on Amazon. He recently wrote an article for the Huffington Post titled Trump, Christian Value Voters, and the Nazi Comparison. And we'll be talking about that too. I'll link to all of those in the show notes on the Raven Foundation website where you can check them out. So Uncle Bob, I remember in 1985, when I was 6 years old, being in Grandma's kitchen up there in Tacoma, Washington, when your book, Theologians Under Hitler, came out. And I remember everyone congratulating you about the book, which was awesome. but I didn't realize just how awesome that book was at 6 years old.
You were six years old, after all.
Yeah, right. That's my excuse. It's a good excuse. You go through this kind of tour de force of modern theologians and the crisis within Germany, pre-Hitler era, and it's just really a fascinating read. But I want to start off our conversation asking you, how did you get interested in this horrific yet crucially important period of world history?
Well, there are about three steps in the process. First of all, you will know that your grandfather, my dad, Frank Erickson, was a Lutheran pastor. His parents had come from Norway. He and two brothers were Lutheran pastors. So when I was growing up, I was immersed in the Lutheran tradition. That gave me an interest in the theologian side of what I've worked on since my doctoral work in the 1970s. In addition to that, I attended an undergraduate college. In fact, it was Pacific Lutheran University, which was supported by my father. I have four brothers, all five of us, one of them your father, are graduates of Pacific Lutheran University. While there, I was attracted to history because of what I thought were the best faculty members or most interesting ones on campus. And the two who really attracted me were both interested in German history. So when I went to graduate school, it was to study German history. I then applied to the London School of Economics, the University of London, for a PhD program. And in the English system, I had a master's degree by then, and they were asking me to propose my PhD dissertation topic, which is very unusual. It isn't the way it happens in the US. I thought it over. I can remember the afternoon when I was sitting in my office at Willamette University, where I was teaching at the time. And I thought, I think I will go with Nazi Germany for sure. And I will take two institutions that I have been a part of and feel close to and admire, the churches and the universities. And so I proposed that I would study theologians who were professors at universities in Germany and theologians who also had this Protestant Christian background. And I really went into this with what I now understand to have been a naive point of view. I knew about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I knew about Martin Niemöller. These are names that resonate with us because both of them opposed the Nazi regime. Bonhoeffer was arrested and executed. Niemöller was arrested and spent 8 years in prison and finally at Dachau. And I thought that this would be the result of my study. When I did my PhD research, it resulted in that book you've shown, Theologians Under Hitler. And to my surprise, but I think now incontrovertibly, I discovered that Christians in Nazi Germany were much more likely to support Adolf Hitler than oppose Adolf Hitler.
Wow.
That's a starting point, right?
Yeah. It's just a fascinating, and as you say, we hear all about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, but we don't hear about kind of the dark side of the Christian church, of theologians during that time. We hear about the heroes, which is one of the reasons that I appreciate your book so much, is that the dark side of that is the warning. We need to know that as much about that as we do about Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
If I may interrupt, or maybe you've given me the pause to do so, I think that the important thing, the important lesson, is to recognize that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a possibility, and in fact, I think the appropriate Christian response, but he was within a really tiny minority, not just among theologians, but that is true, yet pastors, church members, voters, Christians in Germany responded very positively to Adolf Hitler and the Nazi regime, which to our point of view is shocking. And in fact, it turned out so badly that by 1945 and in the post-war period, most Christians in Germany denied that they had supported Hitler. They tried to bury that past. And that's been a big part of what I've written about as well. I should add that when I began with both churches and universities, I've continued. And if I may add one other publication to what you mentioned, I published a book called Complicity in the Holocaust, Churches and Universities in Nazi Germany. And that suggests that it's not just the churches and the Christians in Germany. I thought that their spiritual values should keep them from not, you know, keep them from seeing Hitler as an appropriate leader, but also university professors right across the board, with some exceptions, with very few exceptions, were willing to support the Nazi ideology and do the kinds of research that fit within the Nazi ideology, including racial science and the heroic image of Germany, the image of Germany rightfully building up its military and trying to establish or reestablish its place in the world. All of that happened within those two institutions that I had learned to admire and was essentially committing my life to when I was a 25-year-old thinking about all of this.
Wow. So did you go through a personal crisis as you are discovering this, a spiritual crisis?
I would say that it affected my understanding of my Christian background. And by the way, I still admire my father and the approach he took when I was, for example, in confirmation classes with my dad and many long conversations we had. So to call it a crisis is perhaps an exaggeration, but I do think that I had to rethink my understanding of Christian theology and the Christian place in the world. And that included, if we return to Dietrich Bonhoeffer for a moment, a really serious understanding or attempt to understand what Bonhoeffer advocated, which was, and especially he did this in his letters and papers from prison in the last couple of years of his life. He said, Christians must learn to live in a world come of age. He didn't want to fight against the modern world. He wanted to understand what it means to be a follower of Christ, what it means to be committed to Christ in a world of the 20th century, and I would say now the 21st century. And that does, in fact, impact Christian ideas, Christian theology, Christian behavior quite a lot.
Let's talk about that. In your book, you talk about many of the social and economic and political crises within Germany before Hitler's rise to power. And all of that should be involved in this conversation. And all of that could be an hour-long episode in and of itself. But as I read many of those crises, I thought, wow, this sounds a lot like the United States at the moment. Could you talk a little bit about those crises in Germany before the rise of Hitler?
Yes, I would be happy to. And in fact, I taught for 40 years, and much of what I taught, especially in the last 20 years or so, has focused on Nazi Germany. It's focused on this research of mine and books I've written and so forth. I've taught courses like Christians in Nazi Germany and a course on the Holocaust. And in all of that, there is at least the possibility that my students could see me coming across as quite anti-German. I don't think that's appropriate for reasons I'll explain, but I do believe that Germans in the 1930s and 1940s made tremendous mistakes historically. They accepted and voted for Hitler. By the way, I think some of your listeners will certainly know that Hitler never won a majority vote in Germany. But he was democratically appointed chancellor of Germany. And then he very quickly took over and created the circumstances of a dictatorship so that the Third Reich, the 12 years of the Third Reich, was definitely controlled by Hitler and the Nazi ideology. But after Hitler came to power, the amount of support he had was astonishingly high for most of the Third Reich. In the last 2 years of World War II, Germany was being beaten very badly. and his support level dropped for sure. And then after 1945, in my view, everybody tried to suggest that they never really supported Hitler. They tried to get out from under the impact that Hitler had had on Germany and on the world. But I do think that Germans supported and participated in the crimes of the Nazi state at a very high level and very willingly. So that could sound a little bit anti-German. And now, if I can get back to the question you asked, that was a long lead-in. I also think that Germany experienced a series of crises from the end of the First World War to 1933, which are unparalleled in modern history. They're a little bit like the crisis atmosphere that we have in the U.S. even today, but I would suggest that the Germans faced much worse and much more threatening circumstances. So that's my starting point. It was very serious, and I think we have to understand German support for Hitler in that context. The first crisis was to lose World War I. Germans lost 2 million soldiers dead in World War I, which you might recognize absolutely dwarfs the entire number of soldiers killed in American wars in our 235 years of history. We have lost perhaps 1 million soldiers in World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War, the Korean War, the Revolutionary War, etc. And if you combine both of the figures from the Civil War, it goes a bit over 1 million loss. But in any case, Germans lost 2 million soldiers in one war in a population of 60 million. So it's astonishingly high. The second thing is they suffered a treaty, the Versailles Treaty, which was quite harsh, taking away much German territory. Much of Czechoslovakia and Poland came out of German territory. France got Alsace and Lorraine back, and all of the German colonies were taken away. They also had to pay very large reparations payments, so large that they really couldn't make much of a dent in it. But the Germans always blamed the Western powers for destroying the German economy through this really harsh set of reparations. Now, that's a starting point which the U.S. has simply never faced. Other nations told Germany what they could do. There were actually French troops on German soil in the aftermath of the war to enforce some of this. And that was very, very serious. And it set Germans to thinking that they were at the lowest possible ebb. How could they come back from this crisis? There's secondly a double economic crisis. One was the worst inflation in history, with the possible exception from the hyperinflation in Zimbabwe today. But the German inflation of 1922 was about a trillion to one. If you could buy a loaf of bread for 1 mark in Germany, 6 months later, you would have to pay something like 1 trillion marks for that same loaf of bread. We have had inflation in this country that sometimes has pushed up against 10%, and we thought it was horrible. To think of 1 trillion to 1 inflation, I think just if you imagine that Bill Gates' fortune couldn't buy a postage stamp after this inflation, that is an indication of what it must have felt like to Germans in 1922-23. Then they suffered the Great Depression in 1930 up to 33 when Hitler came to power. All of that was really horrendous. And I think those two crises by themselves, the loss of the war and the treaty, plus the economic crisis, put Germans in a really bad position, much greater than anything we've faced. Now, shall I go on? There are other elements. The thing that more resembles what we face is that there was a real social crisis, a kind of a cultural war that took place in Germany for sure in the 1920s. And frankly, I would blame it on democracy, because for the first time in German history, they had a democratic government. It's called the Weimar Republic, which was created after World War I. And in this democratic system, they'd had the Kaiser no longer, and they didn't have an authoritarian government that was enforcing essentially the Christian middle class values and points of view dominated by an aristocracy. That preceded the Weimar Republic. In the Weimar Republic, they had a thoroughgoing democracy, which meant freedom of speech, freedom of the press, the right to vote for all minorities, as well as women for the first time. And all of this meant that the dominance of the Christian middle class world and upper class world disappeared. And in that setting of democracy, they also had what we had in the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties. Women's behavior changed. They started, going out and drinking in clubs and so forth. There was an outpouring of, if you see some of the films that deal with 1920s Germany, and Cabaret is perhaps the most graphic one, it shows a really wide open culture where middle class values were being challenged in the form of the culture, in the homosexual life that developed, especially in Berlin and more openly than ever before. So there was a group of people, and including the theologians that I studied, who were quite horrified by what they saw as a moral breakdown. And I said, I think it's because of democracy, which allows equality in principle, and which I think we all support in principle, does make it difficult to impose one's own values on the entire population. There's more to that, no doubt, but that's at least a three-sided crisis in Germany. And by 1933, when they're desperately looking for someone who could save them from that, Christians in particular voted for Hitler. In that article in the Huffington Post that you mentioned, I point out that the most Christian Protestant regions of Germany gave the highest level of votes to Hitler. And really what you could call the German Bible Belt is what put him into office in 1933.
Yeah, we've got a question in the chat room. Suzanne, do you want to come on? And?
This question
really goes to the theological crisis question that I have coming up next. So they dovetail together. So why don't you go and ask Tony's question?
Right. I do want to plug a conversation that's coming up in 2 weeks because Bob's mentioning of the particular risks of democratic equality and the promises of equality and the risks that that raise for people feeling they're losing their positions in society and so forth. We're going to be talking about that with Paul Dumochel in 2 weeks, and how democracies actually are ripe for takeovers by tyrants. So it's an interesting thing we don't normally think about. And it's interesting to hear Bob talk about it in that light with what happened in Germany. But the question that popped up in the chat room is from Tony Bartlett, a pastor and theologian himself, and he's really interested in hearing what the theological roots are for Christian support of Hitler.
It's interesting because in your book, Theologians Under Hitler, you talk about Karl Barth quite a bit. And Barth wrote to Emil Brunner and said that Hitler was a tempting figure for Christians. So this goes along with that, the theological roots of the massive Christian supports for Hitler.
Okay, and if I understood correctly, it was about what Christian groups there were or how groups responded? Is that the word?
What are the theological roots?
Theological roots. Okay.
Yeah, of the massive support for Christians for Hitler.
Okay, one of the theological roots came from what was called the Luther Renaissance at the beginning of the 20th century. And Luther had prescribed a two kingdoms doctrine, taking it directly out of the New Testament when Jesus was asked about whether to support Caesar. And he said, whose picture is on that coin? Give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. Luther stressed that in the in the world of the kingdom of this world, there has to be government. No government is perfect. Some governments even are not Christian or unchristian or even, well, anti-Christian, he wouldn't accept. But he said, it is God's will that those governments be supported, that people be loyal politically. And then in the kingdom of God, you can expect the command, say, of the Sermon on the Mount to apply. You can expect certain forms of behavior, and you should encourage that in the church. Many Lutheran theologians, and actually all three of the theologians I studied in my Theologians Under Hitler book were Lutheran. Many of them took that to mean that support of the authority of the state, including the Kaiser's authority before the war, First World War, and then Hitler's authority, that that was God's will to support that. So that was one theological route. And someone like Bonhoeffer would say that it's not unqualified support, and you have to ask whether the goal of that political authority endorses the most important Christian features of morality. For example, the mistreatment of minorities, stepping on other people, the brutality. And Bonhoeffer, of course, opposed all of that. Bonhoeffer, because of his family connections and otherwise, was very well informed on what was happening once the Jews of Germany were being deported after this outbreak of World War II, and finally also the murder of Jews. And but everyone in Germany, of course, knew that the mistreatment was really extreme, and that by 1942, Jews had disappeared from Germany, so that it wasn't just Bonhoeffer who knew these things. In any case, one ideal of someone like Gerhard Kittel or Paul Althaus was, but now we have this wonderful, powerful authority of Adolf Hitler's state, and God wants us to obey that authority. That was one route. There are other things which I feel played even a bigger role. And I guess the second one would be that along with supporting the authority of the government, virtually all of the Christians who supported Hitler believed that God wanted them to be patriotic Germans and work for the strengthening of Germany, for the improved place of Germany within the world. When Germany under Hitler invaded Poland, which at the Nuremberg war trials was called a war crime, and by any theory of just war theory was a war crime, because it wasn't a defense against Polish threat in any way. But in any case, the churches rang their bells in celebration, and the bishops of the Protestant and Catholic churches and pastors in their churches called out for Christians to be willing to fight and die in advancing the war of the Führer and supporting Adolf Hitler in this attack. And throughout the early years of the war, especially, there was tremendous vocal appreciation of the success of the German military. And that's all under the ruse, under the guise of believing that the two most important things for a Christian are God and country. And that meant for them, Hitler's country. And their nationalistic support, I think, was a really important reason why Christians supported Hitler and didn't see what we see as the immorality of that regime.
Can you talk more specifically about those three theologians that you write about in the book? I was especially struck by Althaus because he is virtually everything that I would want in a theologian. He was a moderate. He wanted everybody to get along. But in being a moderate, he gave his support to Hitler.
It's the word moderate is a word which assumes a spectrum. And that there is a spectrum to the right and to the left, or, you know, to one extreme or the other. And Althaus did try to stay within the middle of that spectrum. And he was not as radical as some of the Christians in Germany. In fact, we'll need to get to them at some point. but there was a group called the Deutsche Christen, German Christians, which were absolutely specifically pro-Nazi. They waved the swastika alongside the flag of Martin Luther. They were very, very anti-Semitic, and they wanted to prove that they were just as good Nazis as they were Christians. Paul Alta, and that group, by the way, was at least a third of the Protestant church in Germany. And that bishop you saw on the cover of the book Betrayal, Bishop Ludwig Müller, was a leader of the Deutsche Christen. Now, Paul Althaus never joined that group. He wanted to be a moderate. And yet, Paul Althaus had one of the strongest quotes that I've ever seen in response to the rise of Hitler. He published it in 1933 and again in 1934. He said, "We Protestants in Germany greet the turning point of 1933, which is the rise of Hitler, as a gift and miracle from God." And the strength of that endorsement is unbelievable. It's not just okay. It's not just that, okay, we've had trouble politically. We needed some sort of change. Hitler's a change. He might be better than some of our other choices. But no, he was a gift from God. He was a miracle from God. And that's Paul Althaus, a so-called moderate. He was also, by the way, the most important Lutheran theologian in Germany for about three decades, president of the International Luther Society from the 1930s through the 1950s. So there's one guy.
Yeah. Do you want to say anything about the other two?
I would like to say something about Gerhard Kittel.
Okay.
Actually, I think all three of the people I described are quite important. Let me just quickly say that Immanuel Hirsch was viewed by some theologians and students of theology in the mid-20th century as the most important theologian in the world. They compared him to someone like Karl Barth, who was both a friend and a rival, and then eventually an enemy. And said, no, Hirsch is much more important than Barth. And Hirsch was also the premier Kierkegaard scholar in Germany through the middle of the 20th century. All of these are kind of alarming things. And he was a total Nazi, a supporter, a member of the party, a supporter of Hitler, even before Hitler came to power, in fairly brutal ways, even as dean of a theological faculty at Göttingen University, and being rather harsh toward any students or faculty members who might not be firm enough in their pro-Nazi point of view. So that was a quick aside to Hirsch, if you consider that quick. But Gerhard Kittel is known as the founding editor of the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, a very important reference book to this day, widely used by pastors to prepare sermons and so forth. That's the English version. It was originally published in German, of course. He was a professor of New Testament at Tübingen University, which had one of the best theological faculties in Germany. He was a renowned figure during his lifetime. And Gerhard Kittel, in 1933, joined the Nazi Party, and he greeted the Nazi rise on June 1st with a speech called Die Judenfrage, the Jewish question. And if you can read that speech today, only in German, I believe, and in that speech, he lists a series of incredibly harsh measures that Jews should have their citizenship taken away. There should be special laws which make it illegal for Jews to go to universities or be professors or teachers or policemen or journalists or authors or have any important position in Germany. And he said the reason for this is that the Jews, who were, by the way, less than 1% of the German population, 500,000 Jews in Germany at that time. He said they are the greatest problem for Germany. This is just sort of the protocol of the Elders of Zion. It's the most outrageous anti-Semitic ideology. And so he was willing to use extraordinary harsh measures. And then he said in that speech, which was then published and sold at least 10,000 copies, he said in that speech, God does not ask us to be sentimental or soft. He thought Christians would be just the sort of people who would see their Jewish neighbor, nice family, see the head of the household lose his job, see them suffer, tremendous economic and other difficulties. Their children can't go to school anymore. And he said, Christians will feel sorry for them, but we shouldn't be sentimental or soft. God asks us to face the difficulty of this question and deal with it as harshly as necessary. By 1944, after 11 years in which the harsh Nazi policies became real, and in which essentially all of the Jews of Germany had been sent to death camps or had fled the country or were in some cases in hiding with underground in secret, Kittel then said that the Christian church and Adolf Hitler provided the twin bulwarks against the Nazi, against the Jewish menace, excuse me. I think of the Nazi menace. He thought of the Jewish menace. And so here's a very, very prominent and by the way, very pious Christian. Kittel had daily devotions with his family where they read from the Bible and sang hymns and prayed together every day. He was very widely invited to be a preacher. He was a theological professor himself, a very pious man whose harshness toward Jews was unbelievable from our point of view. And yet, that to me, Althaus and Kittel speak to where the Christians were. Their smartest leaders were pushing them down that path. And that fit with the general attitude of a very large number of those church members in Germany.
That's just fascinating stuff. Yeah, Tony's saying this is fascinating. You'd mentioned that you wanted to talk about the different churches, the different groups, I think.
Yes. Yes.
There's the Confessing Church. There was the church that you'd mentioned that I can't pronounce.
Yeah, the German Christians, yeah. We can call them. The only problem German is Christians. It's not just all Christians who are German, but a very specific branch.
Do you want to talk about those different groups?
I would love to talk about that because, again, when I started all of this, I sort of knew that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was part of the Confessing Church. Martin Niemöller was. A man named Wilhelm Niemöller, the younger brother of Martin. Both of them were pastors, by the way, Martin and Wilhelm Niemöller. Wilhelm Niemöller became the most important church historian of Protestants in post-war Germany. And for about 20 to 30 years, he told the story of the Protestant church as if it was only the Confessing Church. And that's the first distortion, because among all Protestants, only 20% were associated with the Confessing Church, which is the group that wrote the Barman Declaration and is seen at, they were definitely opposed to this Deutsche Christen group and the perversion of Christian theology within that group. And it almost looked like they were opponents of the Nazis. So if that were true, that would give you maybe 20%. I would say about 35% of Protestants were in the Deutsche Christen, and the other 45% or so were somewhere in the middle. Now, the problem with that particular scheme is that when we look at the Confessing Church, even when we look at the Barman Declaration, we discover that it was not anti-Nazi. It was not anti-Hitler. That is never mentioned, nor were Jews mentioned. The persecution of Jews was never mentioned in the Barman Declaration. And a very clear reason is that those who wrote the Barman Declaration, and this includes Karl Barth and Martin Niemöller, but when they wrote this, they wanted to make sure that they would get the maximum support, maximum signatures, and they realized that they wanted members of the Nazi Party and supporters of Adolf Hitler to be able to sign this document. So, first of all, the Confessing Church wasn't an anti-Nazi organization, although when you look for anti-Nazis, most of them would be within that group. Secondly, a man named Wolfgang Gerlach wrote a book about Confessing Church and the Jews. And what he discovered is that a very large percentage of Confessing Church members were anti-Semitic, including a very famous man, Otto Debelius, who was a bishop in the German church and later became the president of the World Council of Churches. And in 1928 already, he was a bishop or a superintendent of a region, and he wrote to his pastors and said, some people think the word sounds harsh, but I've always considered myself an anti-Semite. So if we look at the leadership or the membership within the Protestant church, we find the confessing church made up of 20%, some portion of whom were anti-Hitler. And then we find the vast majority who were either supporters of the incredibly anti-Semitic Deutsche Christen or supporters of the middle ground, most of whom were quite supportive of Adolf Hitler. So it's a pretty alarming picture, I think, when we look at it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got some questions that are about the present day. So let's move to your article on the Huffington Post, Trump, Christian Value Voters, and the Nazi Comparison. Can you talk about the Nazi comparison? I mean, I guess that, you know, everybody tries to critique their political opponent. You often hear the Nazi card being played. How concerned should we be about the present situation? There's a concern in the chat room about maybe overreacting or underreacting to what's going on right now.
Okay. There's an excellent cartoon in The New Yorker from September 5th. And in fact, it's page 55, if anybody wants to look it up. And it's a cartoon about a booth where you can pay $5 to compare things to Hitler. One person in line is carrying a teddy bear. The next person is carrying a toaster. And the third person is carrying a parrot. Now, I love that cartoon because it is so easy to say, that's like Hitler, or that's so fascist, or that's so Nazi. I've spent most of my career teaching the Holocaust, and I'm fully aware that the Holocaust is a dramatically evil moment in history, and that Adolf Hitler's role was really horrific. And so I want to be very careful myself about not saying, oh, you know, we've got Nazis in this country. Well, of course, we do have some racists. We have some Ku Klux Klan members. We have some white Aryan supremacist people. And that all coordinates with basic Nazi ideas. But to try to say, this is like Hitler, or obviously Trump is like Hitler, I think that is almost always going to be a tremendous exaggeration, and it minimizes who Hitler was and what he did. So having said that, I also wrote this article for the Huffington Post because I think if we don't compare Trump and Hitler, but if we compare Christian voters in 1933 Germany and 2016 America, there are some things that are really worth comparing and, to me, somewhat scary. So my first point is that when Christians voted for Adolf Hitler, when they supported him, and, excuse me for a little bit of a digression, but we haven't talked at all about the Catholic Church, but the Catholic Church was a little bit different and a lot the same. From 1933 to 1945, Catholic support for Hitler was very strong among the bishops, the clergy. There were in the Catholic and the Protestant church some examples of dissatisfaction and so forth. So I just want to add that dimension here. But in any case, when we look at Christian support for Hitler, the thing that astonishes me is that Hitler in his life was anything but a Christian. He had been baptized a Catholic. He never went to church after his adolescence. He was very critical of the institutional Catholic Church and of priests and so forth. And there was absolutely no reason to think he was a Christian. And yet, in the Nazi Party program, they made one claim. They said, we support positive Christianity as the foundation of the German nation. So there's a program that says we support the Christian churches. And there were also statements in March of 1933 where Hitler to the Reichstag added statements like the Protestant and Catholic churches are the foundation of Germany and we support them. So he makes that claim. He also, the middle-class conservative Christians in Germany loved the idea that the Nazis were against vice. Hitler promised to get rid of prostitution, and he did. He cleaned up the streets. He promised to get rid of pornography, and he did. We know that this had nothing to do with his own moral values. And in fact, he did set up brothels for SS officers called the Lebensborn program, where they're actually trying to create more babies for Hitler. And so his moral values hardly fit within this image. Gerhard Kittel went to Cambridge University in 1937, and people said, how can you support Hitler? And he said, Adolf Hitler is a good Christian. He carries a New Testament in his vest pocket and reads from it every day. That was a widespread rumor. And so there were all sorts of Christians who were just buffaloed, convinced that Hitler was on their side. And when we look back and see his immorality, they weren't seeing it that way. And I do think that whatever we might say about Trump, he doesn't look like a particularly good Christian. His lifestyle, the brutality of his language, the way he talks harshly about any opponents, the fact that he once said he's never had to ask God for forgiveness, and that's a pretty poor understanding of Christian doctrine. In all of these ways, his marriages, his adulteries, et cetera, it's hard to see. And in fact, many, many Christian leaders and conservative pundits and so forth have pointed out that this is really strange that the Christian vote in particular, especially the evangelical vote in the U.S., should be going to Donald Trump in very, very large numbers. In fact, if Trump were to win, I have argued in this Huffington Post article, I'm not the only one, and I think it's just a truism, it will be on the basis of the Christian vote, self-identified Christians. And so Christians who thought Hitler was wonderful, and we now would say were pretty mistaken, there are also Christians who think Trump is just right for a Christian president. And I find that hard to accept. But I also think that I worry that some of what Trump could do as president is rather chilling. I don't know that he will. He might, in fact, become president, and in 4 years or even 8 years, we'll say, well, that wasn't so bad. But there's also a greater possibility in my mind that we could say, not that he was a Hitler, not that he set up death camps and killed 11 million people in the Holocaust, but the chances that it would not represent the best of American and the best of Christian values, I think is fairly high.
Boy, that's it. I mean, just this last week, prominent Christian evangelical author Philip Yancey wondered how evangelicals could support Trump, who, quote, stands against everything Christians believe. it's just crazy. And when I hear him calling beauty pageant winners Miss Piggy, and then doubling down on it. Yeah. It just really gives me a great concern. This is one of our most important models in our culture, the president of the United States. Every child wants to be the president of the United States.
Yeah.
And all of this hatred, this animosity that gets channeled against people on the margins, already scapegoated, it's just very chilling and not somebody that I want my children to have as a model. But here's my big problem. One of my big problems, I guess, with this is that people that you and I love dearly are supporting Trump. How do we engage in politics? How do we engage with family members, people that we love, when the stakes are so high, without mirroring the evil that we oppose or the potential evil that we think we are opposing?
That's a very important and a rather difficult question. This particular Huffington Post piece that I've written, I've also sent around to various friends. And one of the smartest women I know teaches at City University of New York, wrote back to me and said, you know, I agree with every word you write, but I don't think that people who are voting for Trump are going to be convinced by earnest liberals describing things the way that you do. And I quite agree with her. That's unlikely. She even added something which surprised me, or I hadn't thought of it this way. And yet I think there's some truth to it. she said she thinks that it's actually the ugliness of Hitler that attracted his voters and that also attracts Trump voters. And that immediately made sense to me that for some people in that culture then and in our culture now, sticking a finger in the eye of elites is very welcome. It's what they feel they want to do. And certainly some of the Trump vote is made up of those people who, because he's not, you know, his constant words, you know, he's not politically correct. And that offends me because I would say that to be politically correct means you want to try to avoid offending people who are minorities or who are not like you, and you want to be polite. That's being politically correct. And he wants to be impolite and abusive and harsh and speak out this anger. Now, I'm not saying that's the people that you and I love. Certainly, there must be others listening who know Trump voters, maybe have people that they love who are Trump voters. And I do not know how to have that conversation, certainly not how to have it without it becoming an aggressive conversation. And I suspect that the results of an aggressive conversation won't necessarily be very healthy or, very helpful. So the root of your question is one for which I don't think I have an answer. I would suggest, if we go back to the sort of foundation of what we're talking about here, that behavior which stays within the values that we most treasure within the Christian tradition, which is essentially love for other people, fair treatment, following the golden rule, which, by the way, is a part of the Jewish and the Islamic tradition, as well as the Christian tradition, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You can see my language is a little bit dated because I was brought up in the King James tradition. But in any case, those would be the things that I think should be our first guide in any conversations we have. A second guide probably is that we can't change everybody's mind. The desire to change their mind remains, and I am torn, as I suspect you are, with how aggressively I will push that. And one of my fallback positions is that I'm talking about people in Oregon and Washington State, and I don't think any votes of people I love will change the outcome in Oregon or Washington. But that's not an adequate answer to the question you raise, and maybe you should be giving us one now because you've been thinking about it.
I have no idea. It's so hard. I mean, I guess that your answer that changing anyone's mind in Oregon or Washington helps me out a lot. You know, I tend to avoid the topic with family members. And there's a bit of shame in that I feel mm-hmm. for avoiding it. So I'm still struggling with it a lot. Mm-hmm. On my blog, I have gotten a little more vocal about it because I do think the stakes are high in this election.
Yeah, I do too.
And even if we don't convince people that we disagree with to vote on our side, I think that it's just as important to name just how high the stakes are and to try to motivate people to actually go out and vote.
So as we talk about the evangelical side of things, there are definitely some people out there who are very concerned and in fact have, like you mentioned, you know, have criticized evangelical or Christian votes for Trump. And one of those people might be known to some of your listeners, David Gushee, G-U-S-H-E-E. And he led a group of evangelicals in creating a statement a couple of months ago against Donald Trump and explaining why Christians should not be voting for Donald Trump. Gushee is closer to that tradition than I am. I come from sort of a left of center Lutheran position that's not attractive to this demographic at all. And so I think there are people who are doing the right thing and maybe will have a way to reach evangelical voters. I wrote this Huffington Post piece, and I don't mean to push it this hard, but if anyone were to Google my name, Robert P. Erickson and Huffington Post, they would find it. I tried to be rational. I tried to be honest. I tried to not claim more than I should. I'm not saying that Trump is another Hitler, but I am suggesting that it's hard for me to imagine why Christian voters in particular would think that Trump is on their side. But like my friend said from the City University of New York, she doesn't think I'm going to change anybody's mind who's already voting for Trump. And I have to accept that reality.
Yeah, absolutely. We're coming to the end of our hour. And I just want to bring in another voice from this. I feel bad asking you to speak for her, but your book Betrayal was co-edited by Susanna Heschel, who's yes. a great theologian in her own right, and also the daughter of really my favorite theologian of the 20th century, Abraham Joshua Heschel. Yes. And I'm wondering if you, I haven't been able to formulate this question, but can you give kind of a, I don't know, what's your relationship like with Susanna Heschel, and bring in kind of a Jewish understanding to this conversation?
I've been lucky enough to know Susanna Heschel for over 20 years. We've worked together on many things, that book which you mentioned, a number of panel presentations at various professional or academic meetings and so forth. We talked on the phone yesterday. I'm going to the German Studies Association meeting, and she's sending her greetings to various people, including the president of the German Studies, who will give the banquet address on Friday night. And in all of these ways, Susanna and I are in very close touch, and I'm incredibly blessed by that possibility and that opportunity. As you mentioned, Abraham Joshua Heschel is certainly one of the greatest Jewish theologians of the mid-20th century. Susanna is very important in her own right, and she is... She and I have worked on these questions about Christians in Nazi Germany. She's written a very important book called The Aryan Jesus, which describes some of those Deutsche Christen who set up an institute they called the De-Judaization Institute. And they not only wanted to get rid of the Old Testament and any of the Jewish portions of the New Testament, which if you read the New Testament carefully, amounts to most of it, Jesus citing, you know, Hebrew scriptures and so forth. In any case, their goal was to get rid of all of those Jewish elements. And then in the end, they also had to try to prove that Jesus himself wasn't Jewish at all, but Aryan, which since 1945 is recognized as an absurdity. The only reason for that doctrine is if you're so anti-Semitic and you want to be Christian, you can't imagine that Jesus, your hero, could have any Jewish blood. In any case, Susanna is a very important figure, and the conversations and the connections I've had with her about the Jewish tradition, as well as the Christian tradition, about Jewish-Christian dialogue and so forth, have been really helpful to me. My wife and I have had a couple of opportunities to attend a Seder. The first time was in Abraham Joshua Heschel's own apartment. Susanna's mother was still alive, and all of their old friends were there, and he was long gone, of course, but his library was there. It was a really remarkable moment. And I think I'm also chair of the Committee on Ethics, Religion, and the Holocaust at the Holocaust Museum. And that is an organization, it's a committee at the museum that has really worked throughout the history of that museum on Jewish-Christian relations, and now increasingly on Jewish-Christian-Muslim relations. And the idea of these three Abrahamic faiths talking with each other and looking for places where they have commonality instead of hostility, I think is a really, really important thing. So those have been parts. When I said at the beginning, my own sense of theology and faith has been changed through the course of my career. These are some of the very, very important changes that I think are part of that.
I think that's a beautiful way to end our conversation. So, Uncle Bob, thank you so much for being with us here today. It was a fascinating conversation. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you, Adam. I enjoy the privilege of being with you today and with Suzanne and with your listeners. I haven't been reading the left part of my screen as much as I should have done, but I really appreciate the responses you're getting, and good luck to all of us.
Thank you so much. Just to let people know, next week on Thursday at 1 o'clock Central, we will be having another interview with our friend Melvin Bray about race in America. Suzanne, do you want to come in and say a word about that?
Yes, I'm really looking forward to it. I've known Melvin for a few years now, and he's one of those people who's really influenced my thinking and changed me, I hope for the better. When Bob was quoting a theologian earlier in the conversation of saying Christians must learn to live in a world come of age, I think that just made me think of Melvin and the way he's encouraging us to read scripture read scriptures in new ways that might allow us to hear voices of oppression and marginalized people that we've been suppressing and refusing to listen to. So it's I think, a great follow-up to this conversation.
Absolutely. That was Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who also talked about religionless Christianity, a fascinating topic too. And has a lot to do with our study of mimetic theory. So we look forward to that conversation. And Uncle Bob, thanks again. Hope you have a great time at your conference this evening. So take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much.